Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, January 14th, 2022. I'm Brianne Doyle, your new host of Rabble Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Where is Chelsea? Where indeed? Well, as some of you may be aware, our dear Chelsea Nash has taken a job at the Hill Times in Ottawa. We'll miss her here at Rabble and wish her well. You may have heard my name on the podcast before. I've been behind the scenes here at Rabble Radio since we launched back in October. I've been the podcast editor and chase producer, so I'm no stranger to the show. I'm excited to be bringing you the news you need to know from rabble.ca every week. So, let's jump right in. Rabble has its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you, and every Friday we break it down for you. It's a good way to catch up on the news of the week, and, as with all Rabble news, look at current events through a progressive lens. The top stories of this week include Omicron in our schools. National politics reporter Stephen Wenzel asks, "What will it take to open schools safely?" Some authorities say children have to get back in the classroom as soon as possible, but epidemiologists warn that if we reopen in-person education without smaller classes and better ventilation, schools will become the single largest block of unvaccinated people. We'll discuss that and more a bit later on our show. First, a different story from Stephen. We listen to his conversation with Chris Duranos. Duranos is Vancouver's community-based research center's National Sexually Transmitted and Bloodborne Infection Testing and Linkage Implementation Manager. Duranos tells Stephen how the company supplies HIV rapid tests across the country. He also explains why, whether in COVID times or not, having accessible sexual health care is something the government should focus more attention on. Here are Stephen and Chris in conversation.
To get started, if you could just introduce yourself and let us know a bit about what you do.
Yeah, so my name is Chris Duranos. I use he, him pronouns. I'm the National HIV and STBBI Testing and Linkage Implementation Manager at CBRC. So shorter title, Research Manager. Basically, we are doing a variety of different research projects. Many of them are focused on HIV self-testing. And we're specifically focused on the gay, bi, queer, trans, and two-spirit community in Canada. And I'm also a registered nurse here in Ontario.
And so can you tell me about how you found your way into this sort of specialty in your work?
Yeah, so after I graduated from nursing school, I was hired by Toronto Public Health as an STI case manager. And there I worked with people living with HIV who were newly diagnosed and helped provide different social supports to them and connect them to various services. After that, I left and worked at Casey House, Canada's only hospital for people living with HIV, and worked in the inpatient program there. I still work there casually, and then an opportunity came up to work on a new initiative related to HIV self-testing through the community-based research center. And so I took the opportunity just because of the innovative ways that we can help people across our country access HIV testing.
Now, as we look at the work that you're doing with the community-based research center, you're calling on the federal government for more funding, stating that Canada's response to HIV, hepatitis C, and other sexually transmitted or bloodborne infections is desperately lacking. Can you talk a little bit about this work?
Yeah, so the funding that that the federal government provides towards prevention of HIV, hep C, and other STBBIs has stagnated, and we can see in the numbers of cases for all of the sexually transmitted infections that they have gone up, barring the pandemic, which is actually really more an artifact of lack of testing, more than actually lack of new infections. So really, Canada can be doing so much more to help prevent HIV and other STBBIs. And so this can range from pharmaceutical interventions such as pre-exposure prophylaxis or other upstream interventions in healthcare that would provide the capacity for people to make healthier choices for themselves. And really, we haven't seen much leadership in the federal government in this area.
And so as an organization, what are you calling on the federal government to do exactly? Are you looking for them to expand testing, or what kind of suggestions are you looking for there?
So specifically, one of the things that we are asking for is to increase funding for HIV to $100 million annually. And this would go towards supporting community-based organizations across the country to provide support for people to prevent contracting HIV, as well as for those who are living with HIV to help provide support services for that. You know, in addition to that, the provinces are the ones that are responsible for actual testing services. And so there are many choices that could be made to increase the accessibility of HIV testing. So as an example, in the Atlantic, all of the provinces there don't offer rapid HIV tests and haven't, despite the fact they've been available for more than a decade at this point. And so the testing options are severely limited and really restricted to people. So people maybe living in rural settings aren't able to actually access the testing that they need.
And so last year, back in 2021, your organization announced the distribution of thousands of free self-test HIV kits. Now, those kits have quite a cost attached to them, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you brought that program on and how you delivered it.
Yes. So the program that we are running currently is the it's called Test Now Community Edition. And we have partnered with various organizations in most provinces in Canada, every province except for Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, and PEI. And so really, in terms of the actual cost, the HIV self-tests have been provided by our research partner, which is called Reach Nexus. And they are a group of HIV researchers from across Canada who received funding from the federal government, specifically CIHR, the Canadian Institute for Health Research. So they've provided the HIV self-test to us in kind. The cost is $35 per test for someone to be able to do an HIV self-test. However, if we think about the cost of going to see a physician, having a physician order a lab, having someone draw the blood work, having it shipped to the lab, having it then processed there, the results go back to the physician, and then the physician needs to provide the result back to the person who got tested. I think that the cost of that greatly exceeds the $35 of an HIV self-test. So really, it comes down to the funding priorities of the provinces for what they choose to spend their money on.
As we look at the pandemic and how testing delivery and healthcare has changed dramatically, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to how having self-HIV testing and having the ability to do that in the privacy of one's own home, can you talk about the significance of that, not just in the pandemic, but generally?
Yeah, so the HIV self-test is an opportunity for people who experience barriers accessing the healthcare system. And like you've alluded to, the problems existed even before the pandemic. People weren't able to access testing either because maybe they were afraid to disclose details to their healthcare provider about their sexual behaviors. They either couldn't access a test because maybe they didn't have their provincial healthcare coverage. And even then, like, for people that were able to access it, often services would be like, there'd be like long waits, long lines for people to be able to access any type of testing. And you saw that on a daily basis in the sexual health clinics in all of the major cities across Canada. And so with the HIV self-test, people can, you know, make decisions about whether they need to get tested without needing to have the physician or nurse practitioner as a gatekeeper to accessing testing. And so this also means that they don't need to then, in the context of the pandemic, necessarily go into a clinic, which, you know, right now is severely limited and not safe just due to the prevalence of COVID with the Omicron variant. So really, the HIV self-test represents an opportunity to provide accessible testing regardless of whether the COVID pandemic is happening or not. But it's an additional opportunity during this time when services have been cut yet again. And we've seen that with each wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, is that sexual health services are just completely shut down or not available.
I'm wondering, too, if you could just kind of briefly go over how the self-test works. How do you do the test?
Yeah, so we did create a video with Travis Lanaff, who is from Canada's Drag Race Season 1, one of the pit crew, where he shows how to do the test. And so that video is available on our website. And Travis is a person living with HIV, so we wanted to also show a positive result from that. In terms of the actual test, it's quite simple. So there are three bottles, one lancet to prick your finger, and a testing device. And so someone would prick their finger, pour a large drop of blood into the first bottle, shake that, put that into the testing device. Then they would add bottle 2 and bottle 3. And then shortly afterwards, they actually would receive a result, which would either show as a negative result or a positive result. So the procedure can take only a few minutes to do, and most people find the instructions to be quite easy to follow.
And as we look at the number of people currently living with HIV in Canada, looking at the numbers from 2018, there's an estimated 62,050 people living with HIV in Canada. But of that number, over 8,000 people weren't aware or aren't aware of their status. That makes 13% of people living with HIV may not know that they have HIV. Can you talk about how this self-testing program is going to help chip away at that number of people who may not be aware of their status?
Yeah, so I think that the number of people that are unaware of their status is way too high. And this is really due to, again, like the lack of accessible testing options. And so, you know, the HIV self-test isn't meant to replace standard lab testing, but is meant to be an additional option that can be layered on. And so kind of taking the analogy of the PCR test and the rapid testing for COVID-19, we can see that our lab system, you know, is really only has the capacity to do so much. And by adding on additional options for people, people are able to actually find out their status. So what we hope is that people who may never go in to get a standard lab test will be able to access information about themselves through the HIV self-test.
And so the idea is that, like a rapid test, you would take that result and then you would go to the next step and have that confirmed that way?
So yeah, a rapid test should be confirmed with a lab test. And what we've seen is that in other countries, people who do have a HIV self-test positive result actually do go and get access and care. And so we anticipate that that would happen here in Canada. However, that's one of the reasons why we're also doing some research on it at the moment. One of the other things, too, is that people may not be ready to face certain aspects of their health. But if they have information about their health, they can also make different choices. So even if they don't choose to access care right away, maybe they might not have unprotected sex with someone if they know that they're living with HIV. So, you know, really there are many benefits for people knowing that their own status, and people can make decisions about when they're ready to actually access care.
And now looking at Canada's 90-90-90 targets, I'm wondering, for folks who might not be familiar, if you could briefly explain what the 90-90-90 targets are, and how is Canada doing at meeting them? Because the target date was 2020.
Yeah, so the 90-90-90 targets are a global set of targets set by UNAIDS, and really it's that 90% of people living with HIV are diagnosed with HIV. 90% of those folks are then started on antiretroviral treatment, which is to help improve their health and also to help prevent transmission of HIV to other people. And then 90% of those folks actually achieve what's called a suppressed viral load. And that's where we actually see that there are no transmissions from people who have a suppressed viral load. And so the numbers that the Canadian government has put out is that we are at 87% of people have been diagnosed with HIV. 85% of those folks have been on antiretroviral treatment, and 94% of people on antiretroviral treatment have a suppressed viral load. And I'll also point out that there is a new target, the 95-95-95, which is supposed to replace the 90-90-90 target for, I believe, 2025. And, you know, we can see here that we haven't actually met those targets in 2018. There hasn't been an update from the federal government on how we've done thus far in the past 2 years. I would also, you know, considering that funding hasn't increased and that there really have been no major investments in HIV prevention from the federal government or the provinces, then I wouldn't anticipate that we're any closer to these targets. I think with HIV self-testing, there is an opportunity for us to help the people who are not aware of their HIV status and close that gap. But really, it needs to be appropriately funded by our governments, and we need to see government leadership in that area.
And briefly, I'd just like to look at one group in particular, folks that have been diagnosed with HIV that are incarcerated. 43% of the inmates with HIV are actually of Indigenous ancestry. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how HIV test delivery, what that looks like in correctional facilities, and if your self-testing program is going to include correctional facilities.
Yeah, so people who are Indigenous are overrepresented in HIV diagnoses, even for those who aren't incarcerated. So we see that approximately 10% of people living with HIV are identified as Indigenous, whereas only 5% of the Canadian population identify as Indigenous. So really, there are lots of structural barriers to accessing HIV prevention services amongst Indigenous folks. And when we look at incarceration, so, you know, theoretically, people who are incarcerated should have equal access to healthcare. And unfortunately, my experience working at Toronto Public Health and engaging with correctional facilities, there are many, many barriers to people being able to access any type of testing service. And as well, even people that are known to be living with HIV have a hard time actually accessing HIV antiretroviral treatment. And really, you know, we've incarcerated folks and then in some cases prevent access to healthcare. And I think that that's really a stain on our society that we have allowed this to happen. Unfortunately, at this point, we aren't engaged in talks with any correctional facilities to provide the HIV self-test. We would encourage any correctional facilities, which are often funded by the province, to consider offering this as an option for folks who may not want to have the stigma of living with HIV known to healthcare providers or possibly the correctional officers as well.
Alrighty. Well, thank you, Chris, so much for taking the time to chat and helping me wrap my head around this topic a little bit better. You know, we're dealing with this one pandemic, but we have been dealing with the HIV and AIDS pandemic for decades longer. So thank you for talking today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
was Chris DeReynos in conversation with Stephen Wenzel. You can read more about Chris's work in Stephen's piece on the site this week. The piece is titled, With Health Resources Stretched, Self-Tests for HIV/AIDS Could Be a Valuable Resource. Thanks for that, Chris and Stephen. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. This week at Rabble, our biggest story was, you guessed it, the COVID-19 Omicron variant in Canada. Stephen Wenzel explores the many-sided issue of sending Canadian children back to school after the winter break in the face of the quickly spreading Omicron variant. The World Health Organization tallied 9.5 million new cases of COVID-19 around the world over the past week. That's a 71% spike from the week before. In Nova Scotia, students were supposed to return to in-person classes on Wednesday. That has now been pushed to January 17th. The province has also announced it is suspending contact tracing for schools, and this could lead to fewer reported cases and a greater risk of exposure to the wider population. Most importantly, it won't give Nova Scotians an accurate and up-to-date picture of how safe from COVID-19 the province's schools are. Nova Scotia's chief medical health officer, Dr. Robert Strang, nevertheless argues that schools are the safest place for children. The province's teachers have a different view. Paul Woosney, president of the Nova Scotia Teachers Union, points out that Strang doesn't work in schools. The research Strang has based his opinion on, quote, does not disclose the real truth, unquote, about how COVID-safe schools actually are, Woosney says. Are we stuck in an Omicron cycle? Evelyn Lazar addresses this question in her latest column, writing, In Canada, we are between a rock and a hard place. Remember when we were trying to flatten the curve? With Omicron, we are, one more time. The only thing that can help defeat Omicron and the Delta variant is to increase the number of people vaccinated. We must also continue with masking, hand washing, social distancing, and isolation/quarantine when necessary. This is old news, but it does not make either the rock or the hard place any softer, she says. Also on the theme of the pandemic, columnist Kathy Crowe shares how the collapse of Toronto's shelters under COVID-19 could have been prevented. Crowe reflects on the recent disease history in Toronto, and this analysis, she says, proves decades of neglect have led to the collapse of the shelter system under COVID-19. In environmental news, David Suzuki encourages readers to challenge large corporations on greenwashing habits. He says, Until we do, they'll continue to grind up nature and spit out profit where rivers, forests, and meadows once stood. And on a different theme, Doreen Nickel visits Bella Farm, a farming community in Erin, Ontario. Sustainability and community is at the heart of everything it does. In collaboration with Everdale Community Farm, Bella Farm was able to distribute 100,000 pounds of organic vegetables to locals in need this year. Nickel writes that the story of Bella Farm proves it's time to embrace new farming and food systems that benefit while reducing our collective carbon footprint. Also on the site this week, Alberta-based writer David Kleinenhage considers the discussion of a mandatory vaccine policy, noting that such a national policy would probably be quite difficult to implement as quickly as needed in the face of the slew of constitutional challenges that could be expected. All the same, Kleinenhage says, this doesn't mean they won't come to Alberta. Jason Kenney will just call them something different. Also on the site this week, Naomi Sayers says that what is often absent from gun violence discussion is the context and other social concerns. Quote, for example, what are the types of social conditions and context that may contribute to an increase in gun violence, in where, how, when, and why it occurs, unquote. Sayers exposes how the exclusion of key context in gun violence data needs to be addressed. Sayers writes, data is political, and how you choose to aggregate and report on data is also political. Finally, it is with great sadness that the Rabble community mourns the loss of author and Rabble contributor Joyce Nelson, who passed away in hospital following an illness last week in Toronto. Joyce Nelson was the author of 7 books and many hundreds of articles and essays published by a variety of magazines and websites, including the Watershed Sentinel and Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Over her more than 30 years as a full-time writer, Joyce's work appeared in at least 25 book-length anthologies published in Canada and the U.S. She also created 23 hours of radio documentary broadcast by CBC Ideas, all rebroadcast by popular demand. A sought-after speaker, she lectured at locales as diverse as the Banff Center for the Arts and Harvard University. Joyce taught at Queen's University and the University of Victoria. She was also an artist and a fiction writer, as can be gleaned on her website. Joyce was a longtime and stellar contributor to Rabble.ca, never more than over the past year when she turned her attention to the climate emergency, exposing the dangerous liaisons between corporate interest and elements of the green economy, and Canada's role in the world. We encourage everyone to read and share Joyce Nelson's work. Our deepest condolences to her friends, family, and community. That's it for Rabble Radio this week. As always, thank you for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcast app you use. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble, but it means so much. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel and Chris Duranos for their interview this week. Thanks also to Carl Narenberg for supplying the music, and to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. I'm Brianne Doyle, and thanks so much for listening to Rabble Radio.